Welcome to another edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live right here on Giants.com. 201-939-4513. Hashtag Giants Chat on Twitter. Paul Dottino, John Schmuck with you. Thanks for joining us. We'll have four guests today, rather, I should say.
Yes.
Talking about NC State, UTEP, University of Texas, San Antonio, and finally we'll close out the show with Michael Pritchard, former NFL wide receiver, talking about his alma mater, Colorado, and Isaiah Oliver, and one of the couple other prospects heading out of that school. So, Paul, we're officially 2 weeks away from the 2018 NFL Draft. It is here. It's coming quick, and the smoke is starting to rise from some of these buildings, some white, some black, some true, some false.
Yeah, you know, John, every year we talk about how many different smoke screens that you're going to run into, and I always say that, you know, was told many, 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 many years ago by one of my Sage football guys that even your mother will lie to you when preparing for the NFL draft. And I get that because there's just so much mystery and so much intrigue. And quite frankly, because that a lot of guys don't even make their second contracts and teams do turn over within a 4 or 5 year period, the draft now is probably, do I dare say, three times more important than it was 20 years ago?
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course it is. And the way that with the salary cap, sure. Absolutely. I mean, having really good players on rookie contracts gives your team a distinct advantage.
It's huge. It's huge. And so, you know, if anything, there are more and more liars born every minute as we progress through the years of the NFL draft.
Well, and I made this point yesterday to Lance, and, you know, I really think that it's an advantage, Paul, that right now, you go through all the mock drafts that I've seen for the Giants.
Right.
I see different names everywhere.
Yep.
When in years past, even when the Giants were picking towards the middle of the first round, you know, you had all these names out there, and, you know, teams then trade up ahead of the guys. Dave Gettleman, and we said this from the beginning, he don't leak, all right? Dave Gettleman ain't telling people what he's going to do.
No.
So the fact that nobody seems to know what the Giants are doing here, trade down, quarterback, no quarterback, Barkley, Chubb, whatever, nobody knows, is a great thing because it really creates uncertainty, which then gives you a lot of freedom when teams start calling up, maybe worrying about trades, getting a player they want at a certain spot. When you maintain that mystery and that type of unpredictability, it gives you an advantage on draft day.
Well, let's make something very clear. Dave Gettleman is not going to close off any possibility, and that includes trading. I've made that clear for months now that, you know, I think the Giants should be very much open to doing that.
And
I think Dave Gettleman, quite honestly, is willing to answer the phone.
And he has not traded down in his past. That does not mean, folks, that he's not willing to do it now. He's only run a draft for a few years, so it's not like he has a 10 or 15-year history of not trading down here.
But he made 10 moves, 10 trades involving draft picks when he was the GM in Carolina. And that shows you that he is absolutely fluid in his thoughts. He is more than willing to make a draft deal or a draft day deal. So I'm confident that he will take phone calls. I think I can say that with confidence. He will take phone calls all the way up until the Giants pick. Now, how much is it going to take? What kind of deal is it going to take for him to pull the trigger? None of us know that. But I am confident that he will take phone calls and listen to them. And that's why all of the various names that you're seeing attached to the Giants right now is good. Because the more names and the more mystery and the more uncertainty that surrounds the Giants pick gives Dave Gettleman more leverage to try to max out any potential deal that he's talking about.
And one of those players that's been named in terms of consideration for the Giants at second overall is Bradley Chubb, defensive end out of NC State. And now joining us on our line is our first of four guests today. That's Tony Haynes. He's the NC State sideline reporter, also hosts their coaches show. You won't find somebody closer and more tied into the program than him, and he joins us right now on Giants.com. Tony, you got John Schmilk and Paul Dottino here in East Rutherford, New Jersey. How are you today?
Going great, guys. How are you?
We're doing great, and
I think
Bradley Chubb is an interesting case study here. My understanding is a three-star prospect. He's not one of these guys that everyone's you know, blowing down the door to get. What did you see from him from when he walked in the door to where he is now? Because to go from a three-star prospect to maybe the first non-quarterback taken in the draft, how the heck did he do it?
Well, it's an interesting story, and he's a young guy. He's one of those rare young guys that always had his eye on the big picture, and he understood that you had to go through a process in order to be great. You know, we have an instant gratification society, obviously, these days. But Bradley Chubb definitely understood where he came from, that there was going to be a process for him to become a great player. And you're right, he wasn't a highly recruited guy. He came in as a linebacker, actually. He played on special teams his first year, and then prior to his sophomore season, they decided to move him to defensive end. And you could see some potential there his sophomore year. You could see the quick twitch ability, the quickness. He was very quick off the ball. Just his quickness alone gave some of the lesser offensive tackles some problems. But he needed to get stronger, and he had to gain weight. I think he's now 40 pounds heavier than he was when he first came to NC State. So it really took a lot of behind-the-scenes work for Bradley Chubb to become a first-round draft pick in terms of his strength and his conditioning and that sort of thing. But, you know, I think the sure sign that showed that he wanted to be great was prior to his junior year, he said he wanted to wear the number 9. And at NC State, if you're a defensive end and you want to wear number 9, those are big shoes to fill, because that was Mario Williams' number. And he was the first pick in the 06 NFL draft, all-time sacks leader, at least at that time he was. And, you know, Bradley called Mario in the summer before his junior year, and he asked his permission to wear number 9.
Wow.
He says, I know it's symbolic, but I want to wear your number because I want to be where you were. I want to be great. And that's exactly what he asked. I mean, there's a lot of pressure wearing number 9. You're a defensive end at NC State. And because certainly Mario Williams was the standard bearer. But I think that's where it really started, that process, because he had his eye on that big picture, and he put in the work necessary to be a great player. And, you know, after his junior year, he considered coming out. But at that time, it looked like he might have been a third or fourth round pick, and he wanted more than that. And so he set very high goals for himself. He wanted to become a first round pick. He wanted to break Mario Williams' career sack record at NC State, and that's exactly what he did. So very mature guy, self-effacing, fun to be around. And, you know, wherever he goes, his teammates will love him, and the fans will love him too.
Can you compare him to Mario Williams as a prospect? I don't think anybody would doubt that Williams was a success as the first overall pick, and a lot of people that you were surprised that he got picked over Reggie Bush. You go back in time, and you know what? That was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Can you compare the two guys as prospects a little bit for me?
I don't know. Their stories are totally different. You know, Mario Williams was a five-star recruit, and he was the most sought-after defensive end out of the country when he left high school. And he's a North Carolinian. And, you know, he came to NC State. He's one of those rare defensive ends. When he got to college, he was ready to play. He was ready to start. Now, he wasn't an all-conference player his first year, but he was already, you know, whatever, 6'6", 280 pounds. So physically, Mario Williams was ready to play college football when he got here. He's one of those rare guys at his position that could do that. And then, you know, by his junior year, Mario was the ACC Defensive Player of the Year, first-team All-American, and he came out after his junior year. I think Bradley probably I don't know that he's as big. I don't know that he's as strong, but he might, in terms of just being quick off the football, he might be Mario Williams' equal. I don't want to say he surpasses Mario Williams, because, you know, you got to put this in perspective. Mario Williams is the first ACC player ever to be picked number 1 in the draft.
Wow, is that true?
And yeah, how about that?
Interesting.
That's kind of crazy if you think about it.
All the
great Florida State players we've seen and the guys Clemson has had. But at that time, he was the first ACC player ever to be taken number 1 in the draft.
Thought about Chubb. Here's the thing I'm wrestling with. We know he's pretty much pro-ready, and he's going to be able to contribute immediately to wherever he goes as a rotational player for sure. I don't necessarily know that he's immediately a three-down player and is a full-time player right away. Now, you've already said there's been tremendous growth during his time at NC State.
Yeah.
How do we know he hasn't actually capped out and reached his ceiling as it stands right now? Or is there more to come from him? Is that just a projection? Because, as Dave Gettleman says, the Giants GM, you got to envision the guy to be a Hall of Famer. He's got to be able to wear that gold jacket. Well, Chubb coming out of school is not a Hall of Famer. He's going to have to work up a couple of more steps to be at that level.
Well, judging by the progress he's made up to this point, I wouldn't sell him short, and I wouldn't underestimate him. He's a guy that's always set very high goals for himself. Another thing that they'll like about him, he's very coachable. You know, he got to the point where in his senior year, he was a great player, but he's not one of those defensive ends that would at times just decide, I'm going to play the Bradley Chubb defense, as opposed to fitting into the NC State defense. But he always understood that he was one of 11 guys. And in order for NC State to succeed on the defensive side of the ball, you know, he had to do what he was supposed to do. Sometimes that wasn't always just lining up in a three-point stance or running around the offensive tackle. You know, he always seemed to be in the right position when they run some twists and stunts and those sorts of things. They also would run some zone blitz packages, so he has experiences dropping off into coverage. And he listened. He not only did he listen to his coaches, his defensive coaches, he listened to the strength and conditioning staff. When they told him he needed to do something, he would do it. And that's why I have a great deal of confidence that Bradley Chubb, while, you know, I think everybody probably has a ceiling, I don't know that we've yet found Bradley Chubb's ceiling. We'll find out.
Let me ask you this. What will be the thing he's got to improve on the most to reach that ceiling? For me, it seems as though when he has to anchor against the run, especially if he's going up against 330, 340-pound offensive linemen in the National Football League, if they get a helmet in his chest, that's something to me he's going to have to do a better job at.
Yeah, you may be right. If you were to ask my opinion, you know, how he makes that transition to playing the run and doing the things necessary in terms of his technique and physically being able to withstand that type of pounding, that makes sense if you consider where he's come from. I mean, he came in, he was 210, 220 pounds. He had to work very hard to just get up to 270 or whatever he is right now. But I think that's probably applicable to a lot of defensive ends who are making that transition from the college level to the NFL. You know, as I said, I used the word process. That was a process for him earlier in his career at NC State. Clearly, after his sophomore year, he knew he had to get bigger and stronger to do exactly what you just mentioned, to be better against the run and be able to hold his own at the line of scrimmage. But you got to remember, after his junior year, he led the ACC in tackles for loss. He didn't lead the league in sacks after his junior year, but he led the league in tackles for loss. So he was his last 2 years, he was in the backfield a lot.
He's a very good, what I would consider, you hear run and chase a lot when you're talking about linebackers.
Yeah.
He's kind of like a run and chase defensive end.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? And the best player of the year, the play that I remember most from this past season, NC State hosted Louisville on a Thursday night. It was a great atmosphere. It was Bradley Chubb against Lamar Jackson, who's arguably the fastest quarterback anybody's ever seen. Louisville ran a little play where Lamar was sprinting out to his right, and Bradley Chubb chased him down from behind.
I saw it.
Him from behind.
I've seen it.
And Lamar, you've seen the highlight. Lamar Jackson's head whipped around immediately. And he wanted to know who in the heck was that, because that doesn't happen to Lamar Jackson. And it was a play that was indicative of not only Bradley's speed, but he's a high motor guy. You know, he saw Lamar Jackson. He had him in his scope, and he was coming, and he was going to find a way to get there. And it was a pretty remarkable play.
We're joined by Tony Haynes, NC State sideline reporter, does their coaches show, very tied into the program. I'm going to jump over to one of Chubb's teammates, Paul, if that's okay. Kentavious Street, who I know a lot of people loved, especially his athleticism. Fortunately, he tore his ACL on his pro day, so he's dealing with that now. What are you hearing? I mean, is he a late day three guy now? And how much potential does he have once he recovers from that injury?
Well, I feel terrible for him. And you got to remember that Kentavious Street, in that class of guys, and all four of their defensive linemen figure to be drafted, their starters. But Kentavious Street was the prize recruit when he came in. He's a guy from a small town in eastern North Carolina, Wilson, North Carolina. But he was the guy that was getting all the headlines, is that recruiting class. He was probably NC State's top-rated recruit in that particular class. And they were trying to figure out what his position was, because he came in as an end. His second year, he was so strong. I mean, he was a beast in the weight room in terms of he was number one in squats and bench press and all those things. They moved into defensive tackle, and he was a guy that played inside and out during his career at NC State. Got to be late in his last 2 years in their pass rush packages on third down. They moved him from outside to inside because they had other guys that could rush from the outside. So, my heart goes out to Kentavious because he worked so hard to get himself in this position, and then tear your ACL. That is really tragic for him. I just hope that he's able to work himself back, and maybe in a year he can get back to being the football player that they all thought he could be. But I don't know. I have no idea now how that impacts his draft status.
I'll go for one other gentleman who's on the offensive side of the ball, Will Richardson, who, I've heard people, and I understand why when I looked at the tape, could potentially wind up being a guard in the National Football League. Your thoughts on what you see from him? What is his potential as a maybe third-day sleeper pick?
Well, first off, he played on arguably the best offensive line in the history of NC State football, if not the best, maybe the second best. Phillip Rivers' junior year back in the day, they had a really good offensive line when they went to the Gator Bowl and they beat Notre Dame, and that team won 11 games. But this offensive line was terrific. I mean, they led the league in the fewest sacks allowed. I think they allowed only 13 sacks this past season. But if you look back to most of NC State's biggest running plays over the course of the year, and they had a bunch of them with Nyheim Hines running the ball, most of them came to the right. And when they were in doubt, when they needed yards on a short yardage play, or they felt like they could kick out and run to the boundary, which they often did, they ran to Will Richardson's side. He was their one of NC State's best offensive line. He was their best offensive lineman. You know, he had a checkered career in and out. He was suspended a couple of things, a couple of times over the course of his career. But when he was out there, I kind of referred to him as old reliable. They would always run to his side when they needed to make a play. And he graded out the highest at the end of the season. And, you know, based on the results from this past year, I think he probably made the right decision coming out. And, I have no idea how the NFL people view him. He was primarily a tackle in his career at NC State.
How about Tony Adams, his teammate on the
– He's tall. And, you know, think about Will. He looks like an attack. I mean, he looks like a tackle. He's tall, and he's got long arms and those things. And, Tony Adams was a four-year starter. It's a rarity that you see a guy come in at offensive line. Usually they might start the last 2 years of their career. Tony Adams – started all four. You know, when he came in, it was by necessity because they weren't very good up front when he was a freshman. Tony's a very cerebral guy. I think one of the things he can do to help you in the NFL, and I know this is important, is that he can play center and guard. He has played some center. I think he came in as a center, actually, out of high school. And so he can play both of those positions. And I know in the NFL, with the short rosters, they like guys that can play multiple inside positions.
Yes.
And Tony Adams is one of those guys that can do it.
I want to ask you about Nyheim Hines, the guy that those two big offensive linemen were blocking for. Boy, he looks like he could be one of those Swiss Army knives in the NFL, little special teams, catch the ball out of the backfield.
Yeah.
He's got tons of speed.
Where
do you see his skill set fitting in the NFL?
Well, he's a home run hitter. That's the bottom line. And that's what separated NC State's running game this past year was Nyheim Hines. He rushed for over 1,000 yards, but he had a bunch of explosive plays, 20 yards or more in the running game. You know, they had a guy named Matt Days who's playing the league right now with the Browns. He was a good tailback, and he would have rushed for 1,000 yards too, but he got injured late in his final year. But Matt Days was a good runner, but he wasn't the home run hitter that Nyheim Hines is. I mean, when he gets to the second or third level, he is a track athlete, one of the best sprinters in the country in track, along with his football prowess. So open field, second and third level, he's a guy that can take it to the house anywhere on the football field. Now, you know, his size is going to be questioned. I get that. He's a very small guy. unfortunately, in the NFL, or fortunately, depending upon how you look at it, kickoff returns are not a factor that much in the league anymore. He was a great kickoff return guy. Another place where he excelled was as a gunner on the outside on punt coverage.
Gunner?
Very good, yeah. He was a great gunner on the outside on punt coverage. They used him because he just outran everybody to get down there. He downed so many footballs inside the 10-yard line this year. I don't know. He probably did it 6 or 7 times. And he would usually beat the ball to its landing spot just because of his tremendous speed. So, very explosive athlete. I'm curious to see where he fits in just because of his size. Not a very big guy.
We're almost out of time, so I want to ask you for a real quick thumbnail on Jalen Samuels, who to me is a tweener.
Oh, my.
I don't know that he's got the power to be a fullback. He doesn't have the speed to be a halfback. Could he be an H-back? I don't know where to put this guy, but I know he's productive.
Well, there's the conundrum. And then for that reason, he's probably one of the top 5 most interesting players in the draft, because that was always the question in his career at NC State. What is his position? And you know what they decided to do? They just kind of created a position for him, and that may be H-back, whatever you want to call it. They just found ways to get him the football in a variety of ways, and then he's great with the ball in his hands. I've always said this. He's got the hands of a wide receiver. He's got the body of an old-style fullback, and he's got the feet of a wide receiver. And you know, but he's not a cookie-cutter guy. But at the end of the day, here's a guy who was not a wide receiver who finished his career as NC State's all-time leading receiver.
Yeah, exactly.
Now you're talking about, this is a school that's produced Jericho Cotri, Torrey Holt, Corin Robinson, a lot of great wide receivers. Well, Jay Sam is the all-time leading receiver. And here's what you have to do. At NC State, when he came in out of high school, they had to figure out how to use him. And I think that it's the same dilemma applies here with a team that chooses to draft him. They've got to build some things within their offense just for him. And if they do it, I don't think they'll regret it, because he has a knack for making plays. It's really amazing.
Appreciate the time, Tony. Thanks so much.
Great stuff, Tony. Appreciate it.
All right, guys. Enjoy yourself.
You too. Tony Haynes, NC State sideline reporter. Then a couple of their defensive tackles coming out as well. That could be day 3 picks. But we want to get to our next guest, and that is Brett Bloomquist. He covers UTEP for the El Paso Times. Brett, you got John Schmelk and Paul Dottino here in New York. How are you?
Real good, real good. Good to be on with you guys.
Well, you got one of the biggest fans of your big hog molly guard at a UTEP this year. Will Hernandez right next to me. So I'm going to give the floor to Paul Dottino and let him have some fun here. Paul, go ahead.
You know, it's funny. John knows me so well about how I believe in the trenches, and there's nothing better than a bulldozer on that front line to really make you salivate. So he calls me up from the Senior Bowl, and he says to me, "Paulie Dott, you're going to love this guy. You check out this guy from UTEP." So, of course, I start looking up the video, and I'm just going absolutely bonkers. So sell me on Will Hernandez. Sell me something about him that I don't know, that I haven't seen, that's either going to make me love him or maybe have questions about him.
Well, first of all, I mean, I guess an obvious question is why he ended up at a place like UTEP, you know, that went 0-12 this past year. And by the way, a team that goes 0-12 in Conference USA and produces a second-team All-American just tells you about how productive he would have to be.
Yeah.
That's not usually the formula you use when you're picking All-American linemen. But, you know, coming out of high school, he didn't initially have his grades. He was getting recruited by everybody and just wasn't academically eligible on signing day. So you look through UTEP's press releases, he's nowhere to be found on there. And well, what happened, that they had a feeling he might get eligible. He was already getting ready to go to junior college, and then all of a sudden he got his scores, became eligible. And UTEP, at that point, Sean Kugler had just taken over. He got fired this past season, but he's now the offensive line coach at Denver, the Denver Broncos. So anyway, he left a scholarship open. Will Hernandez became eligible. At that point, he probably could have created some other options for himself, but he felt some real loyalty to Kugler for sticking with him. Came there, you know, so he wasn't there on signing day. Then he redshirted, So then the next year, all of a sudden, there's this guy I hadn't seen before, really. I mean, I guess I've seen him on the scout team, but he's wearing a different number every week. And suddenly, he's a 12-game starter. And, just amazing productivity. And actually, you know, after the academic problems he had getting eligible, he was a good student at UTEP. And he was also the guy, he probably did by far the most interviews, which you might think is strange for even a star lineman. But he was the Spanish speaker, too. So he did double duty, you know, doing the interviews for Univision as well as El Paso Times. So he was sort of the kind of the go-to guy for a lot of people to talk to, and just a joy to cover. A very productive player for 4 years for, you know, a bright spot on a team that didn't have a whole lot of them.
Watching him at the Senior Bowl, Brett, we know he can move people. He gets his hands on you, you're finished. My question is, in his time at UTEP, did you detect any issues with some of the quicker, speedier rushers that maybe play that three technique that might be able to, you know, be a little bit more mobile and agile than he was?
Well, you know, I mean, he usually was grading out close to 100%. I mean, typically you didn't see people getting a lot of penetration up the middle on him. And, you know, this is a team that ran the ball a lot. And when they had an excellent running back there, Aaron Jones, who's now with the Green Bay Packers. You know, they could run the ball and they could protect the quarterback. They had a lot of other problems on offense in terms of, you know, when the quarterback got protected, what was going to happen next. But, you know, they were a power running up the middle team, and I think a lot of that's because they had a guy like Will Hernandez.
Why
there.
Not?
And they did concentrate on building around the offensive line. That's the one thing they did. But that all started with Will Hernandez, and they were very successful at just, you know, running the ball between the tackles.
You know, it's one thing to be able to deal with the more athletic defensive tackles that now is one of the brands in the NFL. They seem to really like some of those guys. But what is it about his ability to pick up the stunts? Because there will be multiple blitz packages and twists and stunts that come at him in the NFL that he probably hasn't seen before. How do you feel he will handle those?
Well, he's a smart player. You know, right away he was starting as, you know, a 12-game starter as a redshirt freshman. And, you know, frankly, he probably could have started the year before. It's just, you know, the way Cougar was building things, he firmly believed that every offensive lineman redshirts and pretty much stuck to that for a while. But he was a smart guy. I mean, he picked it up in a hurry and, you know, was such a difference maker, you know, from the first game he went in there playing. And, you know, I think they would even tell you straight out of high school, he was a difference maker on the scout team. And, you know, he's always shown an ability to learn. He's really has a high football IQ, as well as, they say, a pretty nasty temperament in a good way, of course. I mean, he never caused any problems at all away from, you know, off the field or anything. But, yeah, a nasty temperament, but also a real high football IQ. He picks things up in a hurry. He's real receptive to coaching and teaching, and that's kind of always been a trait of him.
Is there anything, and this is my final question, Brett, anything that you've seen from him over 4 years, if you were an NFL team and you were making this pick, that you would be, quote-unquote, worried about when you draft Will Hernandez?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess everybody says he doesn't have the longest arms. You know, I imagine that means a lot to some people.
And not when he squashes you.
And, you know, he hasn't played for a winner. He was only on one winning team there. And, you know, I just don't know how much that you can pin on a left guard.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, he hasn't played for winners at UTEP. There was, you know, 1-7-6 team, one bowl appearance. Just, you know, other than that, a lot of losing. But I really don't think he was the guy you would circle and say that was UTEP's problem. I think they had enough of those. So, you know, I think he's a pretty complete deal. And you know, I'm surprised to see. But, I mean, you know, the fact that he's a second-team All-American for an 0-12 team just tells you how good he had to be.
Brett, final question before we let you go. From the rumblings that you're hearing down there at campus, does it look like he might sneak into the late first round? I mean, initially coming off the Senior Bowl, I think a lot of folks thought he'd be a high second-round pick, one of the reasons why I thought the Giants should have him on their radar early in the second round. But in recent times since the Combine, we've heard experts tell us they think he's going to sneak into the 20s, maybe mid-20s in the first round. What are you hearing about his potential selection?
Well, the new coach, Dana Dimmel, said he heard from a scout from one of the teams when they had their pro day here, high second round. But most of the projections now, I think I did something, I found 11 projections, 8 of which had him going in the first round,
yeah.
One of which actually projected into the second round and had him going fourth in the second round to the Colts, I believe, like 36th overall. I mean, you know, and that's just projections. I don't really have, you know, much of a feel for that. Covering the draft is something new.
Brett, if he gets to round two, I'm not letting him get by the Giants. I'll run up with the card.
he's happy to go anywhere. I know that. I talked to him. You know, his hometown team would be the Raiders starting next year. He's a Las Vegas kid, but he said they're the one team that doesn't need an offensive guard.
No, that's true.
Kind of written them off, but he'd love to be a Giant. I know that.
Thank you, Brett.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care.
Great stuff from Brett Blomquist, El Paso Times, covers UTEP. And now our final guest of the show, we stick in the great state of Texas. And we talk to Javi Cardenas from, he runs the rival site for UTSA. That's the University of Texas of San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
And UTSA, not very often, Javi, you talk about somebody coming out of there that's going to be drafted in the first round of the NFL draft. You got one this year in Marcus Davenport. And boy, he has just been a dominant player from a physical perspective, but maybe we haven't seen that in terms of the sack numbers over the course of his career. So I guess the first question I'll start with here, Javi, and again, thanks for joining us, is why don't you think his sack production has reached the double digits in any year that he's been at UTSA?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. I think that is mostly due in part to the fact that he's had to develop over these 4 years at UTSA. He wasn't very highly recruited. I think only New Mexico, UNLV, and UTSA were his options coming out of high school. Being a former basketball player, his body wasn't there quite yet. So, and he didn't take a redshirt year. He played during his true freshman year. So he didn't have time to develop his body. So that's where you see a progressive incline in production. And not just those dominant numbers right off the bat, maybe in his junior and senior year. Just he's had to get to that point. If he maybe had that redshirt year, maybe you would have seen those double-digit sack numbers in his junior year, and then even a more dominant senior year. But since he was thrown in there right away, you know, and being such a, I guess, skinny guy when he came into UTSA, he took a little bit of time to develop his body to get to that where he is now.
I think there's still certainly a lot of upside and development there. And when he gets drafted, he'll be drafted more on projection than production, to work off of what John just said.
By the way, he was 200 pounds when he got to UTSA.
Yeah. So I guess my question for you is, he did a lot of stand-up stuff. Is this a guy who's going to be able to play with his hand on the ground in the NFL, or does he have to be a stand-up defensive end in a 3-4? Will he be able to do any coverage stuff, maybe as a little bit of a pseudo linebacker?
So he can do both, honestly, and he did do both under co-defensive coordinator Pete Golding in Alabama. UTSA ran a hybrid between a 3-4 and a 4-3 defense, so he was asked to put his hand on the dirt a couple times, and he was asked to stand up and pass rush. So he can do both. He succeeded a little bit more in standing up and just doing a bull rush there. But he can, if with the right coaching, and we started seeing it towards the end of the year, he can be a hand in the dirt type of defensive lineman. But he can also be a specialist. A pass rush specialist in Virginia, rush standing up. So I think with the right coaching, he can be whatever a team needs him to be. When he's drafted, I think he's going to be more of a stand-up guy until he can get that coaching and those reps in with his hand on the ground.
Yeah, it's Javi. It's funny. I saw the same thing when I was at the Senior Bowl, and I'm watching him in the one-on-one drills between the defensive ends and the offensive linemen, and he's got his hand in the dirt. And he really didn't have moves. He's, you know, bull rushing, running right into the guy. Then all of a sudden you put him in the game at the Senior Bowl and he's standing up. He looks like a completely different player.
Yes, he was.
So I guess it's very important for him on the next level to get into a room with a good position coach to teach him a lot of the technique and nuances of playing that hand-in-the-dirt pass rushing spot, huh?
Exactly. So he's not the most polished pass rusher you're going to see on tape. He uses a lot of his physical ability to get to the quarterback, to get to the running back, to get penetration. But like you said, once he gets into that pro system, where whatever team takes him, they're just going to need to work with him and refining those moves, getting some technique. And now defensive line coach Bo Davis was his coach here at UTSA last year, and you kind of started seeing that. We started seeing the moves from him. We didn't see just that straight line bull rush. You started seeing him using his hands, maybe some spin moves here and there, and that's definitely something that needs to develop when he gets to the NFL.
I got him listed here coming out of the combine at 6'6", 264. Now, you've already told us about the significant weight gain that he had over the course of his college career. But where do you sense his power quotient is? And when he comes into the NFL, do you expect them to want him to play at around 265 to maintain that stand-up and speed and pursuit ability? Or do you think they will ask him to try to put on additional weight, strength, and power so that he will be able to hold up in a more physical kind of scheme?
So I think that has to do with the speed, right? So throughout his years at UTSA, he gained weight and didn't lose any of that speed, and might have even gotten a little bit faster.
Wow!
So if teams can find that that middle ground of maybe he can get to 270, 275 without losing all his speed, if they can find that middle ground, maybe like that perfect weight, and just leave him there, I think that's where teams are going to find the perfect measurement for him. Or maybe 260 is his preferred weight, which I mean wouldn't be ideal, but still, I mean at that height and weight,
yeah, it's
great prospect.
Yeah, absolutely, Javi. We appreciate the time. Thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully we'll be talking about another great UTEP prospect coming down the pipe in the next few years.
Enjoy the off season.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Javi Cardenas runs the rival site for UTSA. Does a great job. Good information there on Marcus Davenport. So we heard about Davenport, we heard about your man Will Hernandez, and we heard about Bradley Chubb and some of the guys from NC State. In about 10 minutes or so, we're going to hear from Michael Pritchard, former NFL wide receiver, and he also is an alum of the University of Colorado, does some sideline reporting there. So we'll talk to him about Isaiah Oliver and one or two other prospects coming out of Colorado, that in about 10 or 12 minutes. So between now and then, folks, it's us, it's you, it's the calls. We got nobody on hold, so if you want to get in, sneak in a couple points, yell at Paul about quarterbacks or me about Saquon Barkley, have at it. 201-939-4513. Anything you learned, Paul, from those first three guests that jumped out to you?
Well, you know, I think it's pretty obvious, John, that despite the fact that the quarterbacks have gained most of the headlines in this draft, and this goes back till the early fall, it's clear to me that there are so many other guys who have make it grades. And we talk about how it may not be the deepest draft, but there's no doubt there is a bunch of quality picks at other positions. And we've heard from so many people, not just today, but in the last 2 weeks since we've been doing our draft previews, about guys who are going to be solid second-round picks. Mm-hmm. The people are not going to be disappointed with a bunch of these second-rounders. And they're going to be some very good make-it third-rounders and even probably some fourth-rounders given the certain positions. And that, to me, is something that I think we talked about several months ago before the combine, that the Giants are in a good position because they need quantity, and this draft should have quantity at the positions that they want.
If you're sitting there and you need a pass rusher,
well, that's
and
one
you're
of the
looking,
tough ones.
And Marcus Davenport and Harold Landry both on the board at the same time, which guy do you pick?
Wow. I probably would pick Landry.
So would I. This because he's had the production in college in 2016 and looked like a dominant player
right.
against good competition.
He's less of a projection. And in that situation, also, I'm counting on Landry to be a linebacker. Okay? I'm not going to put him down on the edge. He is going to be a flat-out stand-up linebacker for me.
Well, he's going to rush on third downs, right?
No question.
Okay.
No question. But
good.
But that is crazy something ball. That I don't have to project with him. He's done it. So I'm going Landry if I had my choice there.
All right, so let's do it. We got three people on hold. We got about 8 minutes or so. Let's get everybody in. Let's go to Jason in Easton, Maine. He'll be with us first. What's up, Jason?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Doing great. What's up?
Hi. I just had a couple questions for you.
Sure.
I've read, of course, over the last couple of weeks, different things about Odell, how the Giants feel about Odell. One of the things I just read was, and maybe this is just somebody writing, but I had read something about it. They just made it sound like the Giants don't want to pay him, and I'm wondering, is that really the case, or is that just their opinion?
Jason,
I mean,
here's the thing.
Do you guys think the Giants want to sign him?
There's a price and a value on every player in the league. So to say they don't want to pay a player, any player, needs context. Are they willing to pay Odell Beckham $200 million over 10 years? No. Are they willing? Where's that line for him? Who knows? I don't know the answer to that. Only Dave Gettleman knows the answer to that. So are they willing to pay Odell Beckham Jr.? Yes. Are they willing to pay him anything? No. But you're not willing to pay any player whatever he wants. So it's going to be a negotiation.
Yeah, the salary cap won't let you do that. But I would just only caution you that over the last year, the batting average or the percentage of direct hits from the written word that has appeared around this franchise has not been very good. And so just be really careful about that, because there's a lot of stuff out there that's just not been very accurate over the last year. It's gotten really, really wild.
Okay, yeah, it just kind of made it sound like they don't want him anymore, and I have a hard time believing that because he's such a great player.
To have a hard time believing that.
Okay, here's my other question. I'm just wondering, why is it such a big deal? Because I know there are rules that you can't have, like coaches working with the players throughout the year. It's only at certain times. Can you guys just, and I'll just hang up and listen to you guys, why is it such a big issue to do that? Why don't they just allow the coaches and players throughout the year, if they want, to be able to prepare for the season? What are the bad parts about that?
I'm going
to
make this
Thanks,
real
guys.
Quick.
Thank you, Jason.
Yeah, real quick. The players' union had a lot of people in charge who had the most power, who were longtime veterans in the league. So when they negotiated the CBA, the labor agreement, with the owners, they push for as little off-season work as possible, because those guys want to preserve their rich contracts. They want to elongate their careers. They want to stay away from injury. They want to kind of take it easy.
And to not sound like a jerk, the less time younger players have in the meeting room to learn more and take their jobs, the worse off they are.
Okay, so that's what happens when you have only a portion of the union's interests being expressed at the negotiation table. And this is what you get: a CBA that basically results in flag football for half of the season and hurts the development of guys who you're trying to coach up.
And the second part of that, you know what group was not represented at all in labor negotiations?
The young folks.
All head coaches.
That too.
There are no head coaches in there.
Nope.
So when owners are worried about the bottom line, at least some of them, they might be, well, all right, you only, I make this extra $1 million a year, but they like don't show up, they don't put pads on for a few weeks. All right, where do I sign? Because, you know, the coaches aren't involved in that sort of thing. So all that kind of gets put together. And I think they're afraid, Jason, that if you put in there that the guys can meet with coaches if they want, then there's going to be pressure applied to everybody to do it. And then while it's not mandatory, it almost becomes mandatory because some people choose to do it and other people want to keep up. So that's kind of why that optional thing is not in the CBA, because they think it turns into a, even if it's not written down as mandatory, it becomes a quasi-mandatory yeah. type of activity. Duke in Queens. What's up, Duke? Duke,
Hello.
Go ahead, pal.
Hi.
Hello?
Yes,
what's
sir.
Hey, what's up? I wanted to ask you, well, first of all, I wanted to say that I've been listening to you guys for like the past 2 to 3 weeks because I'm interested in the draft, and there's been a select few of New Yorkers, actual New Yorkers calling. So this question right now is from an actual New Yorker
okay.
that has to argue with Cowboy fans. And I just wanted to ask you, besides the quarterbacks, how many wins do you project each prospect to help us get in this upcoming season?
I think
so
it's
three, Bradley, Barkley, and Nelson.
I think it's hard, Duke. I mean,
yeah.
it's hard to put it, like a number of wins on an individual player.
Can't do it.
Like, for example, let's say they draft Saquon Barkley, but they don't draft any of their offensive linemen. Well, then, you know what? The way amount he's going to affect the team is going to change because he doesn't have the blockers in front of him. So, let me put it this way. Whoever they pick, you're going to help the team win football games. But and this is the beauty of football, Duke. This is why it's such a great sport. It's not like the NBA where you throw the superstar on the five-man starting lineup and he's going to add 25 wins to your team. You know, one player, as good as they are, doesn't push the envelope where he's going to turn a really bad team into a really good team, unless you're talking about a quarterback. It's a team effort. So, you know, they could bring in Saquon Barkley. He's wonderful. But if Beckham gets hurt again, or a couple defensive players go down, or, you know, Nate Solder, God forbid, gets rolled on the third week of practice and is out for the year, it's not going to mean anything. So it's just really hard to put a number of wins on an individual player.
Duke, if you listen to the show often enough, you know I like to use two analogies to the game of football. One, the game of dominoes, because there's a domino effect in every single thing, decision you make, player that you deploy. And the other one I like to use all the time is that the NFL football, the game is a spider web where every strand affects the other strand. So it's really an impossible question to answer.
Okay, one last question. Now it's going to be fast.
Sure.
I know you guys, the Giants fans, you're doing a Giants podcast, but do we make the playoffs next year? I know you don't know there's injuries, but do you think we make it?
Way too early to talk about it, but I'll tell you this. John Mara has made it very clear from the moment he hired Dave Gettleman as the GM, he expects the team to be good this year. Those were his words.
And I think they will be competing for a playoff spot.
I think they'll be in the conversation.
If they're not, let me put it this way.
Be very disappointing to a lot of people.
If on December 1st the team is out of contention, I think that would be extremely disappointing.
I would agree with that.
And I would be somewhat surprised by that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be shocked. You're coming off a 3-13 year. I can't be shocked. But I would be somewhat surprised by
there
that.
There should be meaningful games in December.
I would hope. And beyond that, like you said, Duke, with injuries, you just
who knows?
Just can't figure it out. Our final call is Eric in Charlottesville. What's going on, Eric?
Hey, guys. I really enjoyed those two interviews you had earlier.
Thank you.
And specifically because I was really high on Davenport and Hernandez, and now I'm not so sure.
Why?
And I thought this is something you could talk about.
Sure.
Because what I'm thinking is, there's a big risk in taking these small school guys. The competition they're facing, the coaching they get. And I'm trying to remember if Jerry Reese had, or someone had mentioned they were changing the philosophy and taking only big school guys because of the competition and the fact that you had a better chance of hitting on a pick.
Well, 2 years ago, 2 years ago, John Mara said, I'm sorry, but 2 years ago, John Mara said, we're going to take less risk.
Yeah,
that was the thought, and I don't necessarily know if that always equates to bigger school guys, but the thought was less risk.
And I would say this too: I think UTEP is in a bigger conference and is a bigger school, despite their record, than UTSA. So I think Hernandez probably went up against better competition than Davenport, if you want to measure it that way.
And they did play in the Senior Bowl, which is the best of the best.
Correct. And Davenport did make plays against some highly rated prospects from bigger schools.
Yeah, I just got the impression from hearing from the local guys talk about them that they seem to be projects in certain respects. And I didn't realize that until I heard that today. But anyway, just an overall thought that, you know, the small school guys, you're just taking a bigger risk.
I think to some extent you do, because you're right. And thanks a lot for the call. We got to make sure we get our final guest in here. Yeah, I think to some extent you're right, because you're not seeing them on film against top competition. I don't think Will Hernandez is a project. There are things he has to work on, sure, but day one, he's going to walk in the building and he's going to move people. I mean, you know he can do that. Just look at him. He's got the neck roll. He's got the whole thing. I mean, just look at the guy. He's going to move people. Now, might he struggle a little bit in, you know, against quicker three technique? Sure, and that's something he's going to have to work on. I think Davenport is more accurately described as a project to me. I mean, you heard from Javi.
I agree.
He made the point that, look, he doesn't have a lot of pass rush moves. He wins on his athletic ability. That's what he said. And I told you that's what I saw at the Senior Bowl. I didn't see moves. I didn't see the stuff. You know, Bradley Chubb is so advanced with his hands, and he swipes and he dips and he swims and he does all that stuff. You don't see that from Davenport. So I could see Davenport in year one doing very little from a defensive end getting sacks situation. I think year one, well, Hernandez is starting 16 games for you, and he helps you in the run game right away.
We'll make it clear for you. Davenport, in another year with deeper defensive ends in the draft, he's a second-round draft pick.
That's possible.
Okay, but right now, people are talking about him as a late first-round draft pick.
Not even late, Paul.
Maybe even
the
mid.
Teens.
Yeah, and that's because it's much deeper at guard than it is at defensive end. I'm with John on this. Look, you can scheme a big, massive, powerful offensive guard into what you want to do,
sure.
and you can plug and play right away with him. Davenport, not necessarily. He's going to be a sub package guy on the defensive end, and then quite frankly, how many snaps he gets, that's going to be a developmental situation.
All right, now it's time for our final guest. And we're joined by Michael Pritchard, former NFL wide receiver. You probably remember him from his time with the Atlanta Falcons. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he also went to Colorado. So who better to talk about Isaiah Oliver, the top cornerback coming out of Colorado this year. Michael, you got John Schmoke and Paul DeTio in East Rutherford, New Jersey. We appreciate the time today. Thanks a lot.
I appreciate you guys. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. You know what it's like to deal with corners that can be a pain in your rear end. Why is Isaiah Oliver going to be a pain in the rear end for NFL wide receivers next year?
Well, because he's long, guys. You hear it all the time in the NBA. That player's long. He's a good wing player. I mean, he can do so much with the spacing concepts. I think Isaiah Oliver kind of presents that as a defensive back now in the National Football League. At least he will present that. He is the guy who prides himself at challenging receivers at the line of scrimmage. And he's got these long arms that, as a receiver, that's a little bit intimidating. You know, if I'm not off the ball as a flanker, if I'm on the ball, I got to be physical, equally as physical as Isaiah Oliver, because I know he's going to try to stab me at the line of scrimmage, and that's something I got to do and I got to deal with in terms of trying to make sure I have the timing on the route. So I just, from a physical presence standpoint, Isaiah Oliver is intimidating. So that's impressive to me for the next level.
Let me ask you this now, Mike. The techniques that some of these guys are using in college, they can't always get away with in the pros against some of these wily, highly skilled veteran receivers. I'm curious as to how polished you think he is in terms of, can he help a team right away in their sub-package, let's say, or can he challenge for a starting job depending upon who the competition is?
You know, it's going to be tough for any rookie to challenge for a starting job in the National Football League. I don't care who you are. It's going to take you some time to adjust. But in time, yeah, Isaiah Oliver, he certainly has the talent to do that. I think right off the bat, I mean, any team that drafts Isaiah Oliver will have a guy that they could certainly sub in. He's an outside-the-numbers player. He's a deep quarter player, too. I mean, you can play him in that hybrid situation if you want to try to match him up with a tight end. He's just not a cover guy, you know, from a slot perspective, a slot corner perspective. Don't do that to him. I mean, he's a guy that can make plays outside the number. He can tax the football down the field, certainly. But I think he just poses a problem for receivers, especially like a third wide receiver. I mean, you got a third wide receiver, doesn't play that much. He's coming in the game, and then you have Isaiah Oliver matched up against him as a rookie. I think that's going to be a tough job for that receiver.
Based on his skill set and the way you described him, does he have most of his experience in press man? Is that where he's going to be best rather than putting him in a cover three or a cover two zone situation?
Well, you know, cover two is perfect for him because
he presses,
a hard jam guy.
Yeah.
He's a hard jam guy in a cover two system. You know, cover three off the ball a little bit. I think he has great instincts and knows how to drive on the ball, knows how to read the eyes of the quarterback as well. But then, you know, his preference certainly would be press man. I think Colorado, we played a lot of press man, and you know, that was his preference. Probably not his forte immediately in the National Football League because, like I said, there's some nuances he's going to have to learn. But once he gets those nuances down and he becomes a pro, I think the sky's the limit for Isaiah Oliver. And I really love the fact that he can be a hybrid kind of guy. And you're seeing that a little bit more in the National Football League where you have cover guys that will move to safety, or they'll try to match up on a tight end, or they'll match up on a bigger receiver. So I think Isaiah Oliver presents that versatility for any defense.
I don't want to be negligent here, Mike. I need to ask you, how is he in run support? You know, we've seen the Deion Sanders types who can cover anybody, but then maybe don't want to come up and hit too many people, especially when they're 225 pounds.
Right. Yeah, I played with Deion, and, you know, he did not like contact. But No, you know, Isaiah Oliver, I think he's a hard-nosed kind of guy. Right? And that's what I mean about the hybrid situation, too. He doesn't mind sticking his nose in there and mixing it up a little bit. He's physical at the line of scrimmage anyway, trying to jam wide receivers. So any running game that breaches the perimeter, he can be an effective player, an effective defender, making a tackle out there. So certainly he wants to cover like any cover corner guy would want to do or any secondary player would want to do. But if they see run action come their way or run after the catch action, he's definitely going to make the tackle out there.
We're joined by Michael Pritchard, former NFL wide receiver, does a good job covering Colorado, also on 104.3 The Fan in Colorado, hosts a morning show out there. Michael, one thing, and you mentioned the techniques with the NFL, and it's tough to make that transition to start right away. And I think one thing that a lot of collegians struggle at, especially when you're in that press man, you're in maybe a trail position, is to keep your speed up, stay with your wide receiver, get your head around when the ball's in the air, and make a play on the ball in the air and not allowing the wide receiver to separate from you when you do that. How is Oliver in that transition when the ball's up in the air, going from his man coverage to locating the ball in the air and making a play on it without committing a defensive pass interference penalty or allowing the receiver to get open?
Well, because of his dimensions, I mean, I believe Oliver already has that confidence. You know, a lot of guys who are shorter cornerbacks, I think they have a tendency of trying to locate the receiver as they look back, and therefore they commit the pass interference penalty.
Yeah.
But you have a guy over 6 feet who's a track guy, too. I mean, he's very confident, highly confident in his speed, with his speed, that, you know, he has that supreme confidence to understand that he's got position in a man-to-man technique, and all he has to do is kind of locate the football. And so with that confidence, that helps the defender tremendously. And I'll give you another reason why I think it's going to be okay for Isaiah Oliver is when you get to the National Football League, and again, learning the nuances of playing corner as opposed to playing corner in college, you're taught different things. You know, the nuances, okay, let me look at the receiver's eyes. When those eyes get big, okay, I'm going to look for, you know, look behind me and look for the football.
Yep.
If I see a receiver's hands trying to come up to make the catch, okay, now I'm going to turn around and look for the football, or I'm just going to knock it away once the ball arrives. Those little things as a professional athlete is what's going to be highlighted to Isaiah Oliver, therefore making him a better player.
My final question for you, Mike, in talking about Oliver, I noticed from the stats that I checked up on with him, was a punt returner a year ago, and then in 17 didn't nearly return as many punts. What was the story there behind him not getting as many special teams reps? And then finally, do you think his special teams value will help or enhance his draftability? I think a lot of people think he is in that second cluster of corners in what is a very deep cornerback draft.
Yeah, it is deep. I think some people have him as the fifth best cornerback in this draft. I mean, they really love his size and his speed. You know, as far as a returner, he got banged up a little bit this year or this past season. And so, you know, not taking a chance that way and just trying to get him back to full strength really during the course of the year, I think was a priority for the Buffaloes. But, yeah, he's very effective. He can do it. He can certainly be a punt returner. I don't think he's going to be Devin Hester type. He's not going to be anything like that. But certainly he can do that job. But as a special teamer, too, I mean, you're looking at a gunner. You're looking at a guy running down on kickoffs. You're looking at a special teams player that could make an impact too. But, you know, immediately Isaiah Oliver to me is a sub-package guy that can turn into a starter, but also gives you the versatility of being that hybrid cover corner slash safety guy. And then on top of that, he's going to add to the depth on special teams. So he fills out that roster for you. And that's important. You know, 1 through 53 is more important to have that at high quality than certainly your starting 11 on offense, starting 11 on the defense. So I think Isaiah Oliver just presents so much for an NFL franchise.
Two more quickies, Michael, for me. He went up against Michael Gallup and Dante Pettis, who could be day two picks this year. How'd he do against those guys, and what did you think of watching Gallup and Pettis in those games? How do you think they might translate to the NFL level?
Well, you know, I had a sideline seat, Isaiah Oliver versus Michael Gallup, and that was a matchup. That was the first game of the year, the Rocky Mountain Showdown, and a good matchup. Isaiah Oliver, I think, got the best of him. You know, first game of the year, I have tremendous respect for Michael Gallup, too. I think he's going to be an excellent pro. But that first game of the year, That goes Isaiah Oliver. And then Watson Pettis, I mean, he's that slot guy that, you know, Isaiah Oliver didn't really match up that much.
Got it.
And he did so much. I mean, they moved him around up there at the University of Washington so much. Isaiah Oliver, he's an outside the numbers cover corner. But again, he gives you that ability to do that safety slash cover guy on the outside hybrid situation. He is not a slot receiver or inside receiver cover guy.
Got it. Final one for me, and I'm going to throw a little bit of a curveball here. Philip Lindsay, the running back from Colorado, small guy, 5'8", just 190 pounds. I've talked to some of my scouting buddies, and they seem to think he could be a day three steal as a third down back type in the NFL.
Yeah.
Do you think he has a future in that role?
Yeah, I do. I absolutely love Philip Lindsay. I mean, I've met Philip Lindsay, you know, when he was a young guy, a young pup, and he was a highly intelligent football player, a tough kid, too, for being so small. The NFL is so specialized now, too. When you have a rotation at running back with certain franchises, he fills a distinct role that can be highly explosive on an offensive side of the ball. So, yeah, I think he has a future. He's tough enough to play 16 games. He can give you special teams contribution as well. But he's just a football player, and he loves the game. And anybody that gives him an opportunity, I believe, is going to have a steal there.
Michael, we appreciate the time. Thanks so much. Good stuff. Have fun on your show today, and we'll talk to you down the road, all right?
Enjoy the offseason, Mike. Thank you.
Yes, sounds good. Okay, thank you.
That's Michael Pritchard, former NFL wide receiver for the Falcons. Now he does some sideline work for Colorado and on 104.3 The Fan in Denver, Colorado. That's it for today's show. Hope you got some good education on the four schools we touched on today. I know we did. Excellent work for everybody out there. Paul, always a pleasure as well.
Absolutely.
Tomorrow it's Jeff Fiegels and I. We do Alabama with Phil Savage, who also runs the Senior Bowl. Good stuff from there. And Dan Orlovsky, former NFL quarterback on the quarterback class. And it's Lobster Day. I've gotten word. Charlie has sent the lobsters. They're in the mail. Jeff Fiegels receives his prize tomorrow. We'll see you then on Giants.com. Have a good day, everybody.